There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Reeswood, I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is at the controls. And Happy New Year, because we're doing our third annual year in review. And for the year in review, John Anderson from DIYmedia.net and Free Press's Media Minutes is with us live in the studio for the first time, at least for this year in review segment. So we're just going to run through it all, the whole year, in less than 30 minutes. Stay tuned. Well, welcome, John. Thanks for joining us here today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
And as I mentioned just before, the first time you've done the year in review live.
I know, the pressure is so on right now.
Yeah, it's like a pressure cooker here in the WEF studios.
With three people in here, the body heat is just like we should be taking off our clothes or something.
But
we'll do that later this evening.
We'll stay clothed until after midnight.
See if I can find a copy of Nelly's song to play for some bridge music.
That's what we really need to have. So, again, another interesting year for grassroots media and as well for just media policy in general. Of course, this year you started producing Media Minutes.
Yes,
weekly,
I did.
A 5-minute overview of media news for Free Press, the media reform organization.
Yes, I did.
And so now you've been doing this for several months now.
Since the middle of October is when the first shows came out.
And what kind of stories have been at the top of your list during that program?
Boy, well, the whole Sinclair fracas was obviously a big one, and we, meaning I, did a bunch of stuff on that. Also, the media and how it influenced the election outcome and some of the coverage or lack of coverage things that have been taking place there. We've been doing a lot of broadband and community wireless coverage, most recently with what happened in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with the whole state law that Verizon lobbied into effect, basically forbidding most of the state from ever building their own public wireless network.
That law gives it's a little more fine-tooth than that, but pretty much, I mean, that's the essence.
Basically, Philadelphia was going to build this big wireless community wireless network, and they were going to offer it free to anyone in the city, and Verizon, which is the dominant incumbent local exchange carrier, basically the phone company in Pennsylvania, said that that wouldn't be very good for their business and that they wouldn't be able to sell broadband as well. So they lobbied the state legislature to effectively implement a law which said Philadelphia can go ahead and build its wireless network. Anyone else, any other municipality or public entity that wants to build a wireless network must ask Verizon first. And they must basically give Verizon a year to decide.
Yeah, the right of first refusal.
Right. And once those networks are built, they cannot be upgraded, which is the big sticker for the folks in Philly if they actually go forward with the plan that they've laid out. And this is an issue that's actually starting to blossom around the country. Obviously, we have something not quite the same here. It's not municipal. It's actually a community wireless network with QIN. But in Atlanta, they're preparing to do the same thing. In Wisconsin, specifically in Madison, they're beginning to do the same thing, although slightly different in that they're contracting out to the incumbent local exchange carrier, who will then pay the municipality to run the network.
So that's a bit more like cable television, like a franchise.
Yeah, thing. And then statewide, I guess there's some sort of wireless initiative brewing in California, and so I'm actually cooking up some stories for the beginning of the year on that. did a piece on Time Warner considering embedding digital expiration dates in programming so that when you save something on your TiVo, it's only good for 2 to 4 weeks.
And that's already happened, I understand.
Yeah, it's happened in limited...
with HBO.
Right, with HBO, but Time Warner would like to run it out on all of the content channels that it programs.
Yeah, that's interesting because people are... there are many DVRs that you can get now, TiVos, that will also have DVD recorders, and there are people who are planning to tape The Sopranos, for instance, and then run it off to DVD and finding out, one, after 2 weeks, that Sopranos episode disappears, and two, they can't run it out to DVD.
Ah.
So there's a couple things going on there, and that's because of the pressure that large media conglomerates are putting on TiVo.
Right, and you know, we've also covered some stuff on indie media, we've done some stuff on the micro radio movement and what's happened, low power FM and what's happened or what's not happened with low power FM over the course of the year. And it's just oodles and oodles and oodles of media fun. You go to freepress.net/media minutes, all one word, and that will bring up the Media Minutes homepage. The latest 6 shows are archived on the front page, but there's also an archive page that goes all the way back to October. Oh, and I also did a special montage of the St. Paul media concentration hearing that happened, in November? Sometime in November. Took 3.5 hours of tape and condensed it down to 16 minutes. I was really proud of myself for that.
Well, Free Press was one of the sponsors of that.
That they were. So I was able to get the full
special
the full
insider
deal.
Access.
That's right. And just wait till the middle of next year, especially May. April and May, the National Conference on Media Reform, which is Free Press's big hoedown that they have. They're trying to do it annually, but they missed this year, and they're going to have the next one in 2005 in St. Louis, and I'll be running around with a microphone, again, gathering a plethora of audio, and then doling it out in 5-minute bits.
So I'll be following you around, too.
Yes.
We'll bring Drew this year.
It'll be fun.
I'll try to be there, yeah.
And we'll all make some good independent media goodness. One thing I want to mention is where people can hear Media Minutes, besides online, but if they're here in Champaign-Urbana, they can hear it as part of Bob McChesney's program on WLLL, 1
yep.
p.m.
Yep.
Sundays on AM 580.
We kicked off NPR News for the top of the hour, so at 1 o'clock straight up, instead of going into NPR News, you get me.
You can listen to that on the radio in Illinois, and you can listen to it on the internet live on WILL AM, which is www.ill.uiuc.edu. I think they also archive Bob's program
in real audio and MP3
format. In real audio and MP3. You can get there. I know that one of the Media Geek affiliates, KRFP.
In Moscow, Idaho.
In Moscow, Idaho. It's also playing Media Minutes.
Yeah, there's 4 affiliates so far. Will, a station in Chicago, an educational station, but it's downtown, so that's really cool because it's in the middle of the city.
Is it WZRD?
No, it's the one that I can't remember his name. Mitch, Chicago Media Action. He's got it on some...
Mitch Shapanchik.
Yeah. He's running a show called The Ministry of Truth now, and he's popped it in there. The station in the LPFM station in Moscow, Idaho, and then one in Salida, California, KQRP.
And also another Media Geek affiliate.
Yes, I'm just glomming off of what the inroads you've made.
We're growing an empire together, John. That's right. That's indeed what we're doing from the ground up here in the cornfields. Well, going back just a second, you mentioned Sinclair, mm-hmm. which is the owner of TV stations here in Central Illinois around the country. In fact, the largest independent owner of TV stations in the country with regard to raw numbers of stations.
Yeah.
And, in the big controversy this year was they wanted to run a documentary very critical of John Kerry,
mm-hmm.
Along the lines of the Swift Boat Veterans advertisements, which they backed off a little bit from and yeah. aired a somewhat hastily thrown together news in quotes program.
Piece of crap is what we call it.
Or you could call it a piece of crap. But in the process, it seemed to me it woke up a lot more people to not just the issue of media ownership, but who is owning their own local channels, which is something I think people are often very unaware of. And they assume, because they often hide the names behind local holding companies like, you know, the Sinclair doesn't do this, but I know Saga Communications.
Clear Channel does it with their radio stations.
Does that. And so if you look at the owner of the Saga stations here in town, and it's something like Champaign-Urbana Broadcasters Associated or something
Ooh,
like that.
Sneaky.
When it's really Saga is the chief owner. And I think it really woke people up. Do you get that same sense?
Yeah, well, I don't want to say it's funny because this is such a serious issue, but I can't think of another word right now. The funny thing about all this is for the past 4 or 5 years, I've just gone around, and not like I evangelize in public and run around with the soapbox that I put on corners and stand up and talk about media concentration.
Well, perhaps
and stuff.
You should.
Yeah. Indeed. I agree.
that'll be my next. That'll be my lecture circuit. Part of the empire.
Sidewalk lecture.
That's right. But you get a sense just from talking to people, if you bring it up in conversation about the media, there's this uncomfortableness, like this grimy feeling that something is amiss with the media, but we're not quite sure what it is. And that's because, obviously, the media doesn't cover what happens in the media. And when it does it in the business press, in the business section of newspapers, and you know, not everybody reads those. But with the Sinclair thing, people experienced firsthand this bait and switch, or shell game, if you want to call it, when it comes to we're local but we're not. And that specifically what I'm talking about is Mark Hyman and The Point, which is part of the News Central automatic, fed from Baltimore newscast.
Or it's inserted into the local news, like right. At the stations here, which still have local news, although we don't know for how much longer.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to a lot of people because obviously there was a protest here at Channel 15 when the whole thing went down with Stolen Honor and the controversy around that. And a lot of people were saying, you know, I was watching this news and I was watching Mark Hyman and he was saying all this reactionary stuff. And I thought, where is this guy? Like, where is he in town? How come I don't see him around town? How come I don't hear this guy around town? And enough people got together and went, you know, this is just too unlike what Champaign-Urbana local media should be. It did not fit the general public's mold of what they thought local news should be. And then it came out through this whole controversy that, oh, by the way, Sinclair is you know, farming out significant portions, if not all, of their local newscasts to Baltimore. And
yeah, we've been covering Sinclair for a long time on this program. And in fact, over a year ago, dedicated almost an entire half hour to examining Sinclair, and especially this new Central program. One of the comments that someone made to Drew and I when we were at the protest covering it was, the first time I saw it, I thought it was Saturday Night Live. Because it seems so, they thought Mark Hyman, because it came right at the end of the news, right, you know, right before the next program would come on, because it seemed so comically reactionary right-wing, and the name even seemed a little bit contrived.
Right.
They said, well, it's just Saturday Night Live, it's just starting a minute or two early.
Yeah.
And then we're pained to find out, no, this is on every single night.
But I guess, you know, to bring my little rambling bit here to a close, what happened is, you know, people might have been intellectually aware that there was media consolidation going on, but once they experienced it personally, once they tuned into their local channel and realized that they were getting fed a line, that energized people. You know, it made people realize that this is a significant problem. It affects me on the local level. It affects my information diet, and I should do something about it. And I think that just as the pattern of consolidation continues in most of the mass media, and as more people get touched personally by the effects of consolidation, you know, the issue can only grow.
I think one thing to look out for is, as we go into 2005, the affiliation of the local Sinclair channels, 15 and 20, in Champaign-Urbana and Springfield, is going to shift from NBC to ABC. And one of the scuttlebutt is one of the reasons why it's shifting is because NBC likes its affiliates to run true local news, and they are not happy with Sinclair, and they are not happy with News Central.
Yeah.
And so continuing NBC affiliation was perhaps one of the stumbling blocks in them rolling out News Central to all of their stations, specifically here in Champaign-Urbana. So you should keep an eye on it to see what happens when the switch from NBC to ABC happens. And the other thing, corollary notice, is that recently there seems to be a big advertising blitz by both the local stations that do local news, Channel 3, WCIA, the CBS affiliate, and the Sinclair affiliate, and doing lots more billboards, lots more print advertising, specifically regarding their news programs. And I'm wondering if that has any meaning or whether it's just a matter of, you know, gamesmanship, you know, got to match each other, advertisement for advertisement, or whether this is going to be, take a look at us, now we're going to roll out something even better and new and not so local anymore.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. Just looking at the radio side of things very briefly, there seems to be a resurgence, at least in smaller markets, of the hometown station, of the remaining independent owner, say, in a small town, positioning themselves as, hey, we're the local people. We live here, and we cover community things, and you should listen to us because we cover community things. And I think that's good, but I think it's kind of sad that that's now a niche. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right. No longer the mainstream. Well, you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical look at our media environment. I'm Paul Reisman. I'm your host. Drew Tirico is our producer. He's at the controls today. And of course, you can check us out online, www.mediageek.org. And of course, if you have a comment, send it along to me at paul@mediageek.org. John Anderson of DIYmedia.net, as well as a producer of Media Minutes for Free Press, is our guest today for a year-end wrap-up as 2004 comes to a close. And so one of the things that you cover quite a bit on DIYmedia.net is pirate radio and free radio.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going into an inauguration in 2005. And one of the things I noticed recently and it, is that there is a station, a free radio station, operating in Washington, D.C.
WQST or SQT? I can't remember.
SQT for SQT? Squat.
Yeah.
For Squat. And it was operating on AM.
Mm-hmm.
And recently,
1680 or something.
Yeah,
like
recently
that.
Switched expanded itself AM. To FM. They said because it allows them to move more because CNN, apparently a CNN reporter, heard the station and heard them calling for all sorts of protests in the streets against the upcoming coronation. I mean, you know what I mean. For George W. Bush in Washington, and decided to look into it, and in proceeding to do a story on them, called the FCC to say, do you know about them? Okay. And the FCC office said, no, we don't, but thanks for the tip. we will now be monitoring it.
All right.
But, you know, pirate radio has often played a role in with regard to large protests and other sorts of actions like
this
that.
This is true.
In Seattle and in the RNC, many different things, and now it looks like in Washington. What's interesting, I guess, is that it seems like I hadn't heard of this station before. I don't know if you had.
It's actually been around for at least, I want to say, a year.
Really? Okay.
And it's basically run by one guy.
Okay.
I can't remember what the guy's name. It's something strange, but
it's a pseudonym.
Yeah, okay. Is that Daffodil Swain? Is that the guy that runs it?
I don't know.
Yeah, Dr. Daffodil Swain. Great name. he's only been just doing. He corresponds on Alt Radio Pirate, the Usenet news group, and things like that. And he's always had like a little SIG file at the bottom that says station. Call letters and frequency, but no website, no anything like that. And he hasn't been like publicizing what he does. Just corresponding with technical information is the way I learned about the station actually, because the guy who's behind it's actually kind of a pretty good DIY tech guru.
Well, that's
type.
What he claimed to have built himself an AM transmitter out of dumpstered parts.
Yeah, for 40 bucks that transmits 10 miles or something.
Yeah. Which is certainly possible if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, and I've got a perpetual motion machine in my basement. But if he does, that would be great, and that's the kind of thing that would really further democratize this technology. And I mean, it's gotten to the point now where you look back 10 years, and there wasn't the range of quality kits out there where people could build their own transmitters and actually have them perform within FCC specifications, whether they're actually certified by the FCC mm-hmm. or not. And that's made a huge difference because it's made micro-broadcasters a lot more responsible stewards of the airwaves, even for those who go into it without having the requisite knowledge of radio frequency theory and things like that. And the price points come down, which has just made it a lot more easy for folks without means to normally access the media to put up their own station and have ball. And that's great. It's been a year of not too much activity.
With regard to free and pirate radio.
With regard to micro-broadcasting. I don't want to say that means there isn't activity. It's just that whatever's going on has been, for the most part, low-key, with the exception of a couple of major places like Denver and Santa Cruz.
Well, in Denver, it's been a big game of cat and mouse.
Yes, it has.
I mean, so there's Boulder Free Radio,
mm-hmm.
which I understand has been managed to evade FCC capture.
Yes.
Through all sorts of crafty maneuvers of moving around transmitters and keeping the studio and transmitters apart.
Yes. Yes. And they're not officially connected. What was going on in Denver and what was going on in Boulder was not officially
connected. So there was also a Denver station,
right,
too.
The Denver station, I think, basically took a page out of Boulder Free Radio's playbook. And the problem is that Denver is home to an FCC office. So when you fire up a station in Denver without a license, you're kind of twisting the tiger's tail in his lair, so to speak.
Well, they had been hot on the trail of Boulder, which is, close to Denver, but still a good 30, 35-mile drive.
Yes, but the thing is this year, the Denver field office ran out of travel money. They expended their travel budget, apparently because they were making so many trips to Boulder, which, you know, when the station Cactus Radio, KCTS, in Denver went on the air, you know, the FCC agent there, John Sprague, and his merry men and women, you know, they couldn't go anywhere, and there was a station right in their backyard, so they gave them a really hard time. They were staking out transmission locations.
You don't hear about that too often.
No, and, you know, it was a significant game of cat and mouse for probably a good 2 or 3 weeks, and they got caught because their station was, or their transmitter was at a remote location, and the power went out in the neighborhood. And when the power cycled back on, it kicked the transmitter back on. So the transmitter was on broadcasting dead air, and the FCC was so zealous about catching them that they tracked it down.
So they didn't intend it to be on.
No. So they were on broadcasting dead air for an hour, and the FCC showed up and visited the place. And after that, the folks in Denver said, you know, this is just way too much work for such a limited amount of broadcasting. But they've dispersed the equipment to quote-unquote interested parties, and I don't think that Denver's seen its last micro radio station.
Well, this seems to be something that happens very often, is that when stations decide to go off the air, either because part of their equipment has been seized or they decide that the heat has gotten turned up too high on them and then it's just becoming too risky in their location, it seems like there's this Johnny Appleseed effect, where mm-hmm. then people take the equipment and send it off to people maybe in the same cities, the same state, or across the country who might be able to use it. It's sort of like when Mbana Kantako was taken off the air by the FCC a few years ago in Springfield, other interested micro-broadcasters sent him new transmitters.
Right. And, you know, I mean, yeah, there's a charitable solidarity-esque element to it, but then again, I look at it and go, what are you going to do with the transmitter other than right. be on the air? And if you've already been dimed, yeah. as the terminology goes, to the FCC, and they're you know, riding your booty, then, you know, you send the transmitter somewhere else and let the FCC find those people next.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that's a wonderful generous move from on the part of micro broadcasters, and it is something that is becoming kind of that's a common MO now.
Well, and it seems like the stations are more often being run by collectives rather than single individuals, which I think just changes dynamics, and it's not against the certainly not critical of a single person who runs a station, but it may be that one person is less connected and maybe has fewer contacts than a collective might have.
Sure, and I think that when it comes to covering a scene like this, collectively run stations tend to garner more publicity just because there's more people involved who are talking about it.
Yeah.
And folks that are involved in it on an individual level tend to do it, you know, a little bit more sporadically. They also are expressing a very strong idea about localism and community broadcasting. Yes, it's not as connected to the community as a community station, but again, with low-power FM now in play and the FCC, you know, they haven't really wielded that around like a big stick to beat on pirates yet, but they could. It seems like maybe stations are getting smaller like that. We're starting to see, I think, proliferation on that individual level now. And a lot of stations, I won't say a lot, but many stations that have started as individuals then turn into collectives. One person has a friend over to be on the air who has another friend over to be on the air. Pretty soon, those people both have shows, and then the broadcast day expands, and it expands more.
Sounds a lot like the radio station as explained in 40 Watts from Nowhere.
Yes.
By Sue Carpenter,
that's
a book
right.
which came out this year. But I think one of the disincentives people may have for operating their free radio station like a community station is like, say, a bus that happened to Santa Cruz
mm-hmm.
this year, which was, as far as I know, the second longest running unlicensed FM station in the country.
10 years.
10 years, and they ran really pretty much as a above ground community radio station with the full consent of their city council and really their community, much in a way a WEFT or any LPFM station like KRFP might run.
Right, and they've also, just because of their longevity and the fact that they are very good about giving the FCC a hard time, they're not bashful about calling themselves pirates, you know. They have kind of become an icon in many people's eyes, not just in domestically but internationally, for micro radio in the United States. And when they got busted, within the first 2 weeks, they got $5,000 in donations from all around the country. And then just two weekends ago, I want to say, Utah Phillips put on a benefit concert there with two other bands, and they raised just a boatload of money, and they are sitting prettier than they ever have been now.
Now, and the collective itself is not on the air, although I think they are running a web stream. Is that correct?
Yes. They've rebuilt the studio in the same location that was raided earlier this year, and they're just feeding out a MP3 stream. And there is another group called the Santa Cruz Radio Access Movement, a.k.a. SCRAM, which has taken it upon themselves to autonomously assist Free Radio Santa Cruz in reclaiming their chosen frequency of 101.1 FM. And they're still on the air.
If there's a trend, it seems to be this use of the internet, especially simple MP3 streaming technology, to help do pirate radio by separating the content creators and then the broadcasters. I mean, you saw that at the Republican National Convention in New York. Mm-hmm. There was this the August Sound Coalition came together to put on a really well done web stream of constant news going on from the streets. And I know it was broadcast in New York City, mm-hmm. but it was not broadcast by the August Sound Coalition themselves.
No. Mm-hmm. There were autonomous units running around, actually some of them mobile, something like 8 of them.
Yeah,
eight different frequencies said. Broadcasting
well,
in Manhattan.
It's tough
Manhattan.
To broadcast in New York City with all the tall buildings. It's you know, unless you were able to get on top of the Empire yeah. State Building, even if you're on like a 15 or 20 story building, that's not much vertical space in New York.
Right. Tactically, this is an evolution that was bound to happen. I mean, they've been doing this kind of thing, separating transmitter from studio in the UK for the last 20 years. Right. And now American pirates, for lack of a better word, are starting to come around to it. We're just late to the game, and it's great to see it happening. So
I think the technology is becoming a lot more accessible, too. Like, for example, you've got bootable CDs now out there that you can just boot up a computer, and it turns it into a web stream where you just plug audio into your sound card and you stream away.
So. Well, in the UK, they were always more well-funded because many of the pirates were commercial stations.
Right. And many of the pirates also worked for the BBC. They were engineers at the BBC and whatnot, so they knew their way around radio gear, and they also had access to surplus radio gear.
Which is always very helpful, BBC mm-hmm, being one of the most well-funded broadcasters, especially well-funded non-commercial broadcasters in the world.
Yeah.
So we just got a minute or so left, and here's where I put you on the spot, John, and say... Any predictions of any kind you want to make for 2005, and then we'll play it back next year and make fun of you.
Well, on the micro radio side, I really can't say because it's just one of these nebulous, amorphous things that's kind of out there and evolves organically in various sections of the country. It's not still a consolidated – people think of it as a consolidated movement, but it's not. There isn't that kind of centralized coordination going on. So
it survives, I think.
Yeah, I can't really make micro radio predictions. But on the FCC side, you know, we may see we're probably going to see an appeal to the Supreme Court on the media ownership rules.
Yeah, looks like they're gathering forces and getting their paperwork together.
We may actually start to see the actual rulemaking proceedings re-engage there if the Supreme Court stuff fails. I will be very surprised if Mikey Powell makes it through the end of the year.
Really? You think his days are still numbered?
Yeah, I can't see how he can stub. Well, he's only got two big toes and he stubbed them both already, so... you know, I can't see how he can screw up anymore and still keep his job. But then again, you know, Donald Rumsfeld still in Mr. People are fungible. So, you know, who knows?
Place your bets.
I'm just along for the ride. That's the way I look
right,
at it.
You know, because it's not the regulation that we would want. It's the possible regulations we might possibly have that we have to deal with.
Yeah.
Well, John, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Check out John's website, www.diymedia.net, and you can hear him report the weekly media news, freepress.net/Media Minutes.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.